Okay. Again, Mark 7 is where we are. And just to read the list again in verses 21 through 23, the Pharisees were, of course, objecting to the fact that the disciples of Christ were not washing their hands before eating, which even they recognized to be a ceremonial cleansing, but nevertheless were placing that emphasis upon physical cleansing rather than spiritual cleansing. So Jesus makes that distinction and indicates that it is not what goes into the mouth that defiles a man. And this, I think, this presages a little bit of course, the acceptance of the Gentiles into the kingdom. You remember in Acts chapter 10, God's statement to Peter, "What I have cleansed, do not call unclean." And Jesus is teaching basically the same thing here. It's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a man. Well, that actual statement, even beyond the washing of hands, is something that would be very difficult for the Jew to accept because of their laws concerning what's kosher and what's clean and such. So this is a very difficult thing for them to acknowledge or recognize. But in this contrast, he indicates it's what proceeds out of the heart that defiles a man, and gives a list of those things that defile the heart, beginning in verse 21. It said, "For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, and foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile a man." So, of course, these things are preparatory and predate the establishment of the kingdom. But what we find under the new covenant and in the kingdom, that those ceremonial laws and ceremonial requirements concerning cleanliness among the Jews are largely done away with. Something that was never required of the Gentiles, but it was of the Jews. And there are a number of instances in the Old Testament why they're described as being present, whether it be the laws concerning the ritual purification of a woman after childbirth, for example, or with regard to the eating of unclean food, and the various foods that are being described as being unclean, and there are a number of other different examples that we could give about that. So concerning this, most of those were done away with in the new covenant. What remains, of course, is that sin makes one unclean. And this is what he's establishing here in this context as well. Those things which proceed out of the mouth. And so basically these are a list of sins, which is obvious as you read it. And most of the sins that are listed here are relatively well-defined, easy to know. So I think the primary application is going to be, or the primary time span is going to be in the application. But I do want to read over the list and make a few notes concerning each of these. And if you have any questions or comments to add to them, feel free. We've already talked about the evil thoughts, that it is a generic term. And that which is the origin of evil acts. You know, before you do something that's evil, you first think about it, and that if an individual meditates on good things rather than evil things, that's going to preclude much actual sin. I mean, if you don't dwell on evil things, then you're less likely to engage in evil activities, and so evil thoughts kind of is a foundational thing here, and it's not surprising that it would be the first thing that's on the list. But then you have a list of actual physical acts or things that are done by an individual that would be considered sinful. And the first on that list is adulteries. One of the things that I was thinking of as I was doing a little bit of preparatory work for the class is that when we talk about sin, often we will say that one sin is as bad as another. And in actuality, the Bible doesn't teach that except in one sense, and that is that each sin is sufficient or brings sufficient guilt to equally condemn a man. In other words, it doesn't matter if it's a big sin or a small sin, as to what whether or not an individual stand condemned before God because of sin. So every sin is heinous. Every sin is bad. But there are differences with regard to, for example, the consequences of sin, physical consequences, damage that can be done. There are differences with regard to how God treats sin with regard to those physical consequences and such. And that would especially be seen in the in what was required of the Jews when various sins were committed under the Old Testament. Remember, the Old Testament was both a religious law as well as a civil law. Now, we think of sin, and we treat sin exactly the same way spiritually, because all sin is the same in the sense that it all leads to condemnation. So when it comes to what must I do to take care of sin, either as one who's not a Christian or one who is a Christian, it's the same no matter what the sin is. What is the consequence with regard to the principles of fellowship with regard to any sin? It's exactly the same. If an individual is a Christian and he sins against God, that sin separates him from God. And if you persist in such sins, then we as Christians are commanded to withdraw ourselves from such a one as well because of his rebellion. And that, it doesn't matter what the sin is. It's the same with all sins. And I think sometimes that today people don't treat sin in the same way. You'll have, even in the Lord's church, you'll have some congregations or some Christians who have a view that there are certain sins that we do have to deal with, but other sins, maybe it doesn't involve me or doesn't involve the group at all, that we can just kind of let slide, and that's between them and God, and we're not going to do anything about it. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't work, because the consequence of sin is the same no matter what. Having said that, when we look at the physical consequences of sin, and I have in mind a couple of things. One of them, which is why I brought this up, has to do with adultery. But also with regard to the civil government, we all recognize that there are differences in the impact. We'll put it that way, the impact of sin. So an individual who's guilty of lying, while he may be looked down upon by society, unless that lying is done in a legal sense, that is, lying on a contract or lying in a court of law or something like that, it's not considered illegal. So there's no legal penalty placed upon it. With regard to murder, however, there is, and always, because of the difference in the impact. If you lie, you might hurt a person, but if you murder, you kill a person, so there's a difference there. We, I think, understand that. And I try to think of examples in Scripture where the same thing is true. One of the examples that I can think of is the call to withdraw yourselves from an individual, to mark and avoid an individual who is a bringer of strife after the first or second admonition. I think that as you see the way in which individuals are dealt with, for example, those who are weak-kneed, those who are lame, those who are, in other words, weak in regard to their spiritual faith, that long-suffering is called for, and we may be long-suffering toward them. But with the strife-bearer, man, it's just pretty quick, cut him off, and because of the consequence, because of what will happen as a result of that. But the other one that comes to mind very quickly is adultery. Because when you see the relationship between a husband and wife, and the teaching of Jesus in Matthew 19, Matthew 5, and Mark 10 and other places, it's very clear that that adultery is the lone sufficient cause of marital problems to allow for the innocent party to divorce and then subsequently remarry. It's the only one, and there's not another one mentioned. And so when you get Matthew chapter 19, you know, if a man divorces his wife except for the cause of fornication or adultery and remarry, he commits adultery. So these two in this list, the adultery and fornication, the sexual sins, are described in very unsparing terms in Scripture, both with regard to the destructive nature, a man who commits fornication sins against his own body. An adulterous relationship is destructive to the marriage, tremendously destructive, more than any other evil. And as a result of those things, there are greater consequences, and there are concessions that are made by Jesus in regard to the marital relationship just for that one sin. And so that shows the nature of it, how horrific it is, the consequences of it, the end result of those things. And I think that we need to emphasize that with regard to especially teaching our young people, both the consequences of the sin of fornication, and they are numerous, from the obvious with regard to an unwanted pregnancy to the less obvious, which is a reduction in self-esteem and other problems that might arise. But also with regard to the marriage and how destructive it is to the marriage. So those two, adultery and fornications. Adultery is a subset of fornication. The term fornication comes from the Greek word porneia, and the plain definition is it's illicit sexual intercourse. So when I say adultery is a subset of fornication, you can say that all adultery is fornication, but not all fornication is adultery. It's a type of fornication. But it's one that's spelled out here in this particular place, just like from time to time homosexuality is spelled out in a particular place, because an emphasis is placed upon that type of fornication. Fornication is the general term. It has reference to any illicit sexual activity, which could be, just extremely depraved, up to this case where we have adultery included in there. Adultery is specifically the sexual relations which break the marriage covenant, that is, having sexual relations with one who is not your spouse if you're married, and it's a more limited thing. But both of them have reference to sexual sin and are defilements of the heart. They're just about every list of sin, lust of the flesh, sins that you find in the Bible, you have fornication and adultery mentioned. So they are kind of at the top of the list with regard to what God abhors. Okay. Yvonne, did I confuse you because you got
one? No, but I was just thinking, how do you correlate that with all that goes on in the Old Testament? You know, and new wives and all of this. Because God just opened the pit?
Or? He allowed it. He didn't approve of it, but he allowed it. And that's, you know, that about the only way that you can, and now it was never approved of, and I don't think it was ever considered not to be sin. The only exception to that would be polygamy. That there was a period of time where multiple wives were allowed in the patriarchal age. Because when you look at, for example, Abraham, Sarah, Hagar, there are some things there that you can say, well, you know, they were taking it upon themselves, trying to help God. That wasn't right. But there isn't in the account any explicit condemnation of what was done. When Hagar was given as Abraham's wife. And then the same thing is true with regard to, Rachel and Leah and those kinds of things. Nothing explicitly condemned. But when you go to Matthew 19 and you look at the teaching of Jesus concerning divorce, and they said, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife or remarry for any reason? He said, no. From the beginning, he said, Moses allowed this, but from the beginning it was not so. So God's intent from the very beginning was one man, one woman for a lifetime.
Except I don't think that scripture is the perfect one to talk about polygamy.
No, it doesn't.
Talking about divorcing and putting away, not just adding another
one. I understand that, but I'm just saying that the law from the beginning, I'm going to deal with the other part in a second. The law from the beginning was a man shall leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one. And Jesus restates that in Matthew 19 in the context of divorce. Which is what Gene pointed out, and it's right. But in Acts 17, and that's the most simple passage that I always turn to. There are others that we could address that basically teach the same thing. But it's stated so clearly by the Apostle Paul on the in his address to the Athenians on Mars Hill. In verse 30, he talks about the sins that happened in the past. And the accountability. And he's making a distinction between what went on and what God expects now. And in verse 30 he said, truly these times of ignorance God overlooked, but now commands all men everywhere to repent. God overlooked in the times of ignorance. And you know, I think that it's somewhat understandable in preparatory to the establishment of the kingdom, preparatory to the fulfillment of this this scheme of redemption. during the time when they were seeing through a veil darkly, that there were certain things that God allowed that he no longer allows. A certain patience that he had with man that he no longer has with man. For that reason, we make the same application with regard to our children. We instruct our children, we correct our children, but when they sin, we're patient with them, or when they disobey, we're patient with them for a period of time. Then we get to the point and say, hey, you're old enough now to where this isn't gonna fly anymore. You know better now, and so stop doing it. And we require something of them later that we didn't require before. And I think that's what that passage is kind of indicating. So my only consideration of this would be that those kinds of things fall under the auspices of then and now. And that now, and that's what Jesus said in Matthew 19 concerning divorce. He said that, no, you can't divorce for any cause. And they said, well, Moses led us. And he said, well, Moses allowed it. Or Moses, they said Moses commanded us. And he said, well, Moses allowed it because of the hardness of your hearts. But from the beginning it was not so. So there was a period of time where God allowed it, Moses allowed it, but it's not the way he intended it, and that's not the way it is now. And that's what we have to remember, both with polygamy and divorce. Yes.
But with their hardened hearts, is God going to save them in the end?
Well, it depends. It depends on
but Moses allowed it because of the hardness of your hearts. Mm-hmm. I think they're condemned myself.
Well, That's a difficult thing, because Acts 17 indicates there were certain things that were allowed that aren't allowed anymore, allowed by God that aren't allowed anymore. And the reason for it was because of ignorance. That's what Acts 17:30 teaches. What do you say in Matthew 19 when Jesus made that distinction? Because he said Moses allowed it. In other words, a law was passed to where it was lawful for the individuals to do this. Now, before Moses passed that law, and they were disregarding God's law, then yes, they were condemned as a result of that, because they were violating the laws. Because what was going on is they were divorcing without just cause, and actually they were divorcing and remarrying the same person, and it was just really they were mistreating their wives as a result of it. And it was a sinful situation. So some accommodations were made by Moses, but once it became legal to do that, I don't know that we could say they. If it's a part of Moses' law and that covenant that God established with Israel in Deuteronomy 24 for them to be able to divorce their wife if they give her a writing of divorcement, then under that covenant, I don't know that we could say they were condemned, even though it was the hardness of the hearts that led to that situation or circumstance. Because you remember when it says because of the hardness of your hearts, he's talking as a people. They have become evil as a people to the point where they were so abusing this that an accommodation was made. And I think again that the accommodations that were made from time to time in the past, God no longer makes those accommodations. That's the difference between the new covenant and old covenant. But I don't know when Moses said you can do it, yet from that point on, that when they did what Moses said they could do, that they were violating God's law.
Well, when the Israelites wanted a king instead of judges to judge it, do you think that was all right for them to do that?
No. I mean, their rejection of Samuel was something that was sinful. But
and to me, that's a direct parallel to what we're talking about with the divorce and God saying...
Let me restate it then. It was definitely sin and their sin that led them to the point to where that law was put into place.
And God's going to change the law just because they were sinful?
I think in this case he did, yes. That's the point. I think that's the difference between now he doesn't do that, but then he made an accommodation. I think that's what Jesus is saying there in Matthew 19. That they said Moses commanded it. And he said no, Moses allowed it.
Allowed it.
Because of the hardness of your hearts. But that was a law.
If it had been the law of God, he could have commanded them to. I'm all confused on this. I thought I had it down.
Okay, well let's sit and talk about it, because I don't want to go on if the confusion is there. The way I perceive it or understand it, in Deuteronomy chapter 24, there were, divorce had become rampant. And what Moses did was put a law in place in Deuteronomy 24 that if you divorce your wife, you must give her a writing or a certificate of divorcement. and that she's not allowed to, you're not allowed to marry her again later. That's kind of the law that's put into place in Deuteronomy 24. That became a law of the land. So it became, at that point in time, legal. But it should not be constrained, or it should not be construed by us, and this is what Jesus is saying, as something that Moses demanded them to do. It was a concession that was made. It was a liberty that was allowed that came, the impetus of it was all of this horrific sin that they were doing. So let's say this is where God intends it to be. This is where they are. And for a period of time, Moses puts them right here. For a period.
And God is going to allow people to determine what he's going to do?
Let me ask you, Tippi, in asking that question, is that not what you see from Acts 17? That in times of ignorance, God overlooked some things, but now he commands all men everywhere to repent? Because I think that's what it was. It was an interim time, and Christ hadn't come yet. And so what he's saying is, this is where it should be. This is where you are. I'm going to put it here for a while until Jesus comes, and then for everybody is back here again. I think
I'm going to have to dwell on this.
Okay, that's fine. But that's why I use Acts 17:30 and Paul's statement concerning that, and it correlated that to Matthew chapter 19 with regard to the settings on divorce, because I think that's what Jesus is saying. Because the Jews are coming up and they're saying, what do you say concerning divorce? And what Jesus said concerning divorce was different from what Moses said. So what was allowed under the law of Moses, Jesus is teaching something different. And they're saying, well, why then did Moses say this? Now, the way they put it is, why did Moses command this? And he said, no, you're getting it wrong, because that makes it sound like you're doing what Moses said. No, what happened was you were way over here in the evil, and Moses allowed certain things. But he said, but from the beginning it was not so, and now I say unto you. And then he sets it back to where it was in the beginning. And so there was this period of time when certain things were allowed in regard to divorce under Moses' law that's no longer allowed by God. That's what Deuteronomy 24 says. And Jesus himself said the reason for that was because of this hardness that was present. And so, yeah, I think that's what Acts 17 and Matthew 19 is saying, is that God made a temporary concession because of the ignorance of the times, or because of the hardness of their hearts. But it is a concession that now that truth is revealed, and now that all is accomplished, that he will no longer make. And that's what Paul's telling the Athenians, and that's what Jesus is telling the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 19, that now it's going to be different, and it's not going to be that way any longer.
So that's just in regards to the divorce, putting away the wife, or is that the whole harem thing of having all the women?
Well, there's not any specific passage which deals with the practice of polygamy. As I said, when we see examples of polygamy, there is by when you're talking about, first of all, the patriarchs, as well as by the kings. And so Solomon is the first one that comes to mind. There is no explicit condemnation of the practice of polygamy, or else it would be an easy thing for us to answer. You know, I mean, there are some who the Mormons, which they're way off on everything, but they still maintain that polygamy is something that's acceptable. I know of a particular gospel preacher, and I don't have a great deal of respect for him for other reasons as far as where he stands on Scripture, but he maintains, he's not the only one that maintains that, you know, when it comes to actually looking at Scripture, I can't find where polygamy is condemned. He said, I don't like it, and it's certainly not allowable in America because it's illegal, but where in the Bible does it condemn it? Well, I think the principle that we talked about just now does. Jesus in Matthew 19, though it's dealing with the context of divorce, he sets a marriage law, which is the same marriage law that was in the beginning. So what is in the beginning for a while was no longer there, now it is again, and that law is very explicit in Genesis, that a man shall leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one. So it's a monogamous, not a polygamous relationship that's established from the beginning, and that's what God expects now, what Christ expects. So having said that, when we see polygamy condemned in the Old Covenant, it's more along the lines of evil influences. When you look at, for example, Solomon in his kingdom, I think that it could be said that Solomon was condemned, or his actions were condemned in getting the alliances with these wives and concubines, because of the fact that it led him into idolatry and the people into idolatry. And that's where the sin, if there is condemnation shown, it's because of the evil influences of the wives, rather than in the relation itself. And again, the only explanation I can give for it as to why in the Old Testament polygamy is not condemned when Abraham took Hagar or, any of these other examples, is because of the fact that there were certain things God allowed back then that he no longer allows. And I think Acts 17 very clearly teaches that principle, so that's what I'm hanging my hat upon in that particular application. Because what you see is the teaching of Genesis 1, what you see is hundreds of years later, the practice of the patriarchs, and then what you see is what's required under the new covenant. And for that period of time, there is no explicit condemnation of polygamy.
Could replenishing the earth enter into that?
I don't think that it was necessary or required for the replenishing of the earth. No, I mean that would be speculative on our part. That maybe God allowed it so that people would replenish the earth more quickly, but. I mean, that's an obvious thing, is that you're able to procreate more quickly if you have multiple wives. But you know,
you think of all of the patriarchs, and you think of the ark and how few people were saved. All these patriarchs, some of which we study about, were lost. Is that not correct? When the earth was flooded?
I mean, the ones that were on the earth at the point in time in which the flood came, the one who remained alive, it said that every intent of the heart was evil continuously. So the civilization had degraded to the point to where there were only 8 righteous souls left at that point in time. And polygamy certainly could have been something led to it, no doubt.
And just interesting that he only took one wife with him on the ark.
Yeah, I know.
You know, so...
Sure. I mean, but I'm just saying that I can't say, in fact, that it would be wrong to say, because the Bible very clearly teaches otherwise, that Abraham was condemned because he had 2 wives, or that the other patriarchs were condemned because they were polygamists, because there's no condemnation of that sin, and the Bible speaks of them as being righteous. In Hebrews 11, we've looked at that list of patriarchs there, and individuals who were polygamists were nevertheless considered to be acceptable to God, despite that polygamy.
God's ways are not our ways.
Yeah, it's hard to, and again, it's difficult for us to explain why in polygamy, in that specific example, why there isn't that condemnation or why it was allowed, because we don't know, because it's not revealed to us. Our question, the question is, okay, let's leave that to God, but does that mean that they were condemned because of their polygamy? Apparently not, because we've got individuals listed as righteous who were polygamists. Does that mean that we today can be polygamists? And I don't think that follows either. And I think it clearly doesn't. Polygamy wasn't practiced in the first century. Polygamy wasn't explicitly dealt with by Jesus or the apostles. But when they taught on marriage, it was monogamy that was taught. And so we... At the very least, we're bound by silence to remain monogamous. But I think there are some principles that clearly indicate that was one of those things that was allowed that's no longer allowed. But I just don't know if whatever... I mean, when he was talking about these things, he's... There were certain things that got overlooked in times of ignorance. And I don't know what the extent of them were, and I don't know what his standard of judgment was, but it was an accommodation made until such time as Christ came. And then whatever those things that were overlooked are no longer overlooked, and I think that's what's taught there in Acts 17. Okay? Tippy, if you, after your cogitation, you figure out I'm wrong, then please let me know. Okay?
I will.
Okay, I appreciate
that. I'm not a quiet person.
All right, anybody else with regard to the sins of adultery and fornication? It's an interesting discussion, and that's what these classes are for. So. But anybody else have anything? Adam? Okay, well, let's go on then to a number of other of the sins, and some of them are pretty obvious. Murder, which, by the way, is, let me refine the definition just a little bit. It is not only the intentional taking of human life, but it is the intentional and unlawful taking of human life. I think a distinction has to be made between that and the government which bears the sword not in vain, but the intentional taking, the unlawful taking of human life, of which most is considered murder. That's, of course, why abortion is such a white, black and white issue for Christians, and others say, well, why can't we compromise and such? Well, because if you consider this human life, then intentionally taking the human life is murder, and so those who do it are guilty of murder, and that's a sin, for whatever reason, and it's a difficult thing, and I understand it, but it's kind of black and white for us, so it's hard to compromise on that particular issue. But it is the intentional taking of life. Theft, which is stealing. It's interesting, it says include shoplifting.
And, I didn't understand that, why he wrote that.
Well,
I mean, it's stealing, so it's...
Yeah, but I guess who knows why he put what he did, but I think maybe because shoplifting is so
common.
And I think I know why he put the pilfering, because pilfering has to do with like taking office supplies when you're an employee. You know, that's what pilfering is. Pilfering is this minor thefts, the small things, draining of a company's resources by, you know, a paperclip at a time type of a situation is what we're talking about with pilfering. And that's that term pilfer, even in itself, kind of is an indication of something very small. But that's still
I have a pen. Brian Pittman. It's from Indonesia, and I thought, well, how did I ever get over
that? Yeah, I mean, you know, there's it's one thing if a business or an employer allows for some of these kinds of things and use of them. These days, I don't know there are very many businesses, if any, do, because it's amazing how much how much capital is lost just simply from the pilfering of office supplies. It's just, I mean, there's some figures that came up about it, and it's just amazing. And something we've got to be careful about, even like with the church, there's sort of things that we've put out, for example, pens or something for use, for note-taking and stuff like that, paper and all, and you know, someone just, okay, take it and use it and not bring it back, it's seldom intentional when those things are done, but it's still the taking something that doesn't belong to you. So pilfering, I think, when he put that shoplifting, pilfering was a more important one for him as far as why I put it in there.
I think the shoplifting is because a lot of people treat that as a game.
Yeah, very.
Can I take something without getting caught? It's not about the thing. It's the game of it. So that may be why that's in there.
Young people, too, I can see, since he taught this as a sermon, mm-hmm. that he might want to make sure that the young people understand that if, you know, you're grabbing a stick, a package of gum when no one's looking, but, you know, that's not a minor thing. You know, they'll never know what, you know, who cares? They don't care. Yes, they do. It's and God certainly does.
I've heard people say that they throw that much in the trash.
Why not?
Yeah. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Well, that's their choice to throw in the trash.
As Christians, we can't do it that way. We can't throw that much. Yes.
I was going to say, I remember when the kids were very little, we walked out of, it was Kmart at that time or whatever, and we're in the van, I see Cheryl chewing gum. She was only like, I think, 3. And I turn around right away because I'm like, where did you get that gum or whatever? And she holds up this thing of Bubblicious, and we stopped and we went right back in. And I went up to the counter and and the lady behind the counter was like, oh, that's okay, bring it back. And I said, no, that's not. But they kind of, oh, that's so sweet that she brought it back. And I was like trying to impress on them, no, this isn't a reward. But people, I think, become numb to things.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
It starts small. I mean, you don't all start out being murderers, but, you know, you build up that level, you become numb to what's wrong.
But it's such an opportunity to teach if we use it. Like, I walked out the other day from the grocery store, and Kate and I had gotten a bottle of water. It was up by my purse, and we were drinking it while we shopped, and I forgot to pay for it. And I get out to the car, and I'm unloading, and there's that bottle of water, so go back in. And, you know, somebody wants to say, oh, I can't believe for an 89 cent. But, you know, my response usually is, well, God's watching, so I need to make sure that this doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think that we all have, you know, experienced those kinds of things. We just, a couple of weeks ago, we went to the barbecue place, Spring Creek, okay. And she messed up our stuff bad. I mean, she left off a drink and one meal, and undercharged on another meal. I mean, it was like $8 or $10 that, yeah. And I came back to her, and when she saw me with the deal and coming back, she just kind of went, oh, you see her face drop, you know, and I told her, I said, I think we owe you more than what you charge us. And she just, her eyes got big, and she couldn't believe it. And it's so out of the ordinary for someone to do that kind of thing. It should be characteristic of Christians. Of course, that story that you hear that's just so famous about Abraham Lincoln, that he traveled 4 or 5 miles to pay back a penny or something. You know, his, of course, money wasn't the same as it is today, but it was just that's why they called him Honest Abe, is for those things. And that should be characteristic of a child of God. And that's the point, as Gene said, it's God watching. And of course, with me then, you know, my kids were watching
right.
too.
Right.
You know, I was looking at it and what's wrong? I said, well, this sure doesn't seem like enough. You know, sure enough, it wasn't. And so, you know, when I went back, it was something that was important to me, for, of course, teaching my kids about that. But also, whether anybody was looking or not, if it was just me, it's still important to it.
We probably had another example, but I'll have to give mine.
Yeah, go ahead.
But I shot one day, I only bought a few things, but my husband was waiting in the car, and I got a gallon of vinegar. And after we got in the car, I thought, that doesn't sound like enough that I paid, so I got the bill out, and sure enough, I owed him for that vinegar. So I took the money back, not that day, but I saved my ticket and I took it back. Went to the office manager and gave him the money, and I said this was an undercharge, and explained to him. And he said, they're looking at money. What am I supposed to do with this money? That's your problem.
That's your problem, yeah. Yeah. I mean, because they do generally, they'll write off losses and all that kind of stuff. And, yeah, that's it. When they say, well, you know
well,
this isn't a common
looking
thing.
At, like, well, yeah. Where does
75 cents, you know.
Mine was a $29 skirt. I had bought a skirt and a jacket, and they were sold separately. And I took the skirt back, and I showed her the receipt and everything, and she goes, well, what do you want me to do with it? And I'm like, I want you to charge me for it.
Oh, I'll have to tell mine.
I got a package of chicken.
And it was chicken breast on sale. And I got them and went home. You know, I was in a hurry, and I didn't think anything about the slick. And I got home, and they charged me the last, it was about $10 that I owed them. So the next morning, I took it back, and I showed them and explained. And they kind of look at you, like you say, like they're dumbfounded and everything.
Yeah, well, see, that's just it. I mean, we kind of get tickled at these and like to tell our stories, but it's because of the reaction of the individuals when you show honesty, which is an indication that it's not a common trait in our society.
It's a teaching opportunity because they don't know what to do with the money.
It's a teaching opportunity, as Gene said. It's also just kind of an indication of where our society is, you know, as far as, and again, you know, it's important to teach your kids and everything, because that's not what everybody else is going to be doing,
right.
And they're going to get evil influences that are going to be warring against them. So.
Well, years ago, in San Antonio, a neighbor across the street, I don't know, I think she'd been to Montgomery Ward's, and she came home, and they didn't charge her for a glass. She didn't take it back. She said, well, that's their mistake. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the con.
Yeah. Look at what I get to get away with because they made a mistake, which is just it's not a loving attitude. It's certainly not something that should be characteristic of. So I think, look here. We got four things. No, I really do think because it's a difficult question, but I do think that idea about polygamy. People wonder about polygamy because we so often with the patriarchs we look at their stories and we think, wait a minute, yeah, we can't have many multiple wives. Why were they allowed to? And it's not an easy question to answer. It really isn't.
And I think within that, it's also important to recognize that they were referred to as wives.
Yes.
Not
they were what?
Referred to as wives. Not girlfriends, not...
They were actually wives.
So, you know, that...
So adultery was not ever accepted. I mean, there wasn't any accommodation made with regard to that.
There's the Old Testament, it's hard to understand.
It is.
When you read about all the battles and you go out, not just a few people killed, but thousands.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, 185,000.
If anybody wants to have a good or to read a good article that's written on the subject of why God allowed the destruction of entire peoples and especially with regard to the children being killed as a part of those battles and such, John Robertson, who's a preacher up at Wichita Falls, wrote an article last month in Watchman Magazine. You can go to the archives or probably scroll down the page, but go to the archives for January. I think it's in January they wrote it, January or February. But the title will be, I think, self-explanatory. But he wrote a lengthy discussion and treatment of that were very, very good. And we don't have time to discuss why it was, but basically, they deserved what they got, except for the children who were safe with God. But I mean, he went through and explained it and explained the reason for these kinds of things, and it's really, really a good, well-written piece. And I was glad it appeared in Watchmen, but he did a good job. We'll pick up next time with Covetousness.